Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Now, let's take a look at this book here. It's called Am I Normal? The 200-Year Search for Normal People and Why They Don't Exist. It's an entertaining and sometimes shocking but always exhilarating account of society's fixation with normality, and it charts an eccentric path from colonial obsession to the all-pervasive anxieties engendered by the internet. Encompassing everything from sex surveys to baby weight, beauty standards to sexuality, what you get is a very engaging work of popular science and the origins of an anxiety-ridden modern obsession. And the moral just might be that instead of ruminating endlessly on the worried and unanswerable question, am I normal, we should instead be kind of asking whether normal even exists and even why anybody actually cares. The author of Am I Normal is Sarah Cheney. So, Sarah, welcome to the programme. Sarah, the Victorians invented the idea of normality. Do their mistakes still haunt us?
Yeah, I think absolutely they do, and not least because they could never quite decide what they meant by the idea of normal. So all sorts of different things get lumped in together. So normal as being the average or the mean of a population, normal as being common or usual, or normal as being an ideal or something, that, you know, the best of health, and all of those senses of normal still get jumbled up together and used in our
and
daily
then,
language.
Like when you say average there, did normal shift from an average to an ideal?
I think it actually started as being both at the same time, because the very idea came from what we call today the normal distribution, though it wasn't called it at the time. In the 1830s, when a Belgian statistician called Adolf Quetelet realised that the graph that had been used as an error curve by astronomers to try and determine what their correct measurement was, he realised that when you plotted, say, human heights, if you have a large enough data sample on a graph, then it would create this same curve, this bell curve, with the majority of measurements right in the middle. But because Quetelet came from this idea of the error curve, for him, the true measurement was right at the very centre of the curve, because as an astronomer, the true measurement would be at the centre of the curve. So from the very beginning, he equated the so-called average man with an ideal.
Like the questions, do I have a normal body? Is my sex life normal? Are my kids normal? Like the answer should be, oh, to hell with it. Who cares? Move on. So what? Okay, it's funny because, like, you know, you have your goddaughter, Willow, and I love that. Like you say, she says, what are you doing? She says, I'm writing a book called Am I Normal? So here, I'll write it. So she goes, am I normal? She gives a four-word answer. Now, so her answer was, am I normal? No! Exclamation mark. Deal with it. She's right,
absolutely.
Isn't she?
Yeah, she is. But I think one place where we do get a bit confused today is because, of course, we worry that we're unhealthy. We worry that something might be wrong. And sometimes it could be useful if we're comparing a normal to, say, how we've been in the past. You know, if suddenly you're feeling a lot worse on something, suddenly you have a pain that you didn't have before. So maybe we should be focusing more on what's normal for us.
Okay, now I know I'm jumping back and forth, but just to go back to like the whole of this proliferation of IQ tests and sex studies, and I mean they had a UK beauty map. Most people might know this, but the most repellent women in the world are in Britain or in Aberdeen. Anyway, the oppressive values that are entrenched. I mean, all this normal shaped us all, and it's all kind of silly, is it?
Yes, a lot of it is. And I mean, if you take the beauty map as an example, I mean, this was an entirely subjective study done by one man, Francis Galton, who stood on street corners with his hands in his pockets, using these gloves that he designed to surreptitiously measure the beauty of passing women. And he just graded them all on three levels, from beautiful, average, and repellent, as he put it. And, you know, it stands, Francis Galton grew up in the South. He lived in London. He was embedded in London society and all the fashions and so on. Of course, he's going to find people who are in the same society as he is, and follow the same kind of norms that he'd grown up with as being the most beautiful. But then very often these ideas get separated from their origins, and we think of them as being something static and fixed, when, as you can see with that study, they're entirely subjective.
Well, then let's take a look at exactly who and what is examined. I mean, the Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic, as in weird. I mean, less than 12% of the population, but 96% of subjects in psychological studies and 80% of medical ones and that. It's all skew-ways, isn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I really like some recent studies that have passed, rather than referring to certain groups of people as being ethnic minorities, yeah, we should be referring to them as the global majority, because, in fact, the vast majority of people are not white, Western industrialised people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, by the way, the book is called Am I Normal? The full title is The 200-Year Search for Normal People and Why They Don't Exist. So, Sarah, just on the note of just the actual word normal, I mean, like, if you ask yourself, am I normal? Are we asking, am I like other people? Am I a typical example of the human race? Do I react the same way as others to a given situation? Do I look or do I dress or talk like other people? And if I was more like them, would my life be easier? Is that what the search is about?
I think sometimes we do think all of those things, and sometimes we worry about our health and whether that's normal. And, you know, personally, I grew up with that idea as well, this whole sense of feeling different from other people around you, but not quite knowing how to explain that, as I think many teenagers go through that. But then thinking, actually, if something changed, if I maybe was different, if I could act like other people in certain situations, my life would be easier. But very often that's not the case. Very often, like the structures in our society make it much more difficult for people. Like the way everything is designed on an average, from the height of a light switch to the length of a bed.
Surely the dread of being different is just normal, no?
I think to a large extent it is, but the fact that we often don't really think about it because we're so embedded in our own fears, we don't really think about how it affects other people. So like when you take the sex studies just after the Second World War, for example, the vast majority of people answering those were saying, well, I don't really know what other people do, so how would I know whether what I'm doing is normal? But people worried about it nonetheless.
Yeah, well, then let's get into the more kind of, sinister side of things. I mean, like, first of all, normal was a mathematical term. It was like a line or a right angle or something. It was just back in the 1800s or whatever. And, you know, people weren't normal. Triangles were or whatever. But eugenics, racism, skewed statistical sampling and all that, they've completely misinformed our ideas about normal and mental health and child development and sex, gender, body shape and all the rest. I mean, people got away with, like, a lot of nonsense, didn't they?
Yeah, and I think we need to see that these two things developed side by side. So people like, going back to Francis Galton, who as a statistician and scientist in the late Victorian era, he was Charles Darwin's cousin. He also coined the term eugenics. So Galton's interests in statistics were very much bound up in his concerns about what he thought was the decline of the British race. And his notion of eugenics was that you could alter populations by making sure that those people that he thought had more worth in society, who tended to be rich, white men, yeah, like himself, should be having more children, and those that he thought were less desirable should be having fewer children. And then that informs, especially in the early 20th century, policies and laws across the Western world, from sterilization programs in North America and in Europe, to things like the Mental Deficiency Act in the UK, yeah, which led to numbers of people being incarcerated in institutions for being so-called feeble-minded, which was a very poorly defined term that might often be applied to, say, women who had children outside of marriage.
Yeah, and then a law passed in 1907 in Indiana with criminals, imbeciles, racists, idiots, etc. Do you think in some ways that if that's 1907 and all this was happening in the late 19th century in terms of this guy, Francis Galton, that this might have influenced Adolf Hitler later on?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Eugenics was very widespread, and you know, we might like to hope that this was a fringe idea in the early 20th century, but it wasn't. It was quite a lot of people discussed and were informed by eugenic ideas, and people worried about them in their own lives as well. There's an example of a young woman, a man who was admitted to the Bethlehem Royal Hospital, psychiatric hospital, in the 1890s, and she wrote back to the hospital worrying that if she had children, would she risk passing her illness on? And then, in fact, she didn't marry and didn't have children. So people were worrying about these things for themselves as well as them being applying them to other people. And yeah, that absolutely continued through the 20th century and after the Second World War as well. So as well as informing the Nazis' ideas, sterilization programs did continue after the war, as did the UCL Center for Studying Eugenics.
And just remember that this book, Am I Normal? It's not just any kind of a history book, even though the history is there. I mean, in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality as a disease from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. That's only like 50 years ago, whatever. And then 69 UN member states continue to criminalise consensual same-sex activity, according to the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association. We've still a long way to go, don't we?
Absolutely, and there are things today that are so embedded in our lives that we don't even necessarily think about them. So I think that's why it's quite a bit of a wake-up call when we look back at the history of these terms, because things can see a more distance from us and it can seem more obviously wrong. But actually, there are many things in our society today that in 100 years' time, people will be saying, "I can't believe they thought that."
And I would imagine you writing this book realised that you had an open trapdoor the whole time, because you say so embedded in our lives just there. I mean, in a lot of circumstances, people have always judged themselves by those around them or criticised others for not fitting in. Did you have to stop yourself every so often? Wait a minute, that's just the accepted norm now, but that's exactly what I should be writing against.
I think that's the important thing. We can never be entirely free of it, but I think that certainly shouldn't stop us being constantly critical as much as we can.
Yeah, exactly. And also the rapid rise of statistics down through the centuries. I mean, for physiology, psychology, sociology and criminology, brilliant in one way, but watch it, you know, like be aware of the limitations.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's when we as has been done through history, make the assumption that the average is somehow applicable to real people, when an average doesn't necessarily apply to real people at all, like was found in the example of Norma, average woman, when a sculptor and a sexologist created statues of the average human beings, and they were created from a very specific sample in the first place. In the 1940s, United States, they were made from mostly young white Americans, but then in 1945, a local paper in Cleveland decided to do a competition to see whether they could find the real life Norma. So the statues were called Norma and Norm Man. And so they had just 9 measurements, and they asked women to send in their measurements on all of these 9
things. Like the height, weight, bust, hip, waist, thigh, calf,
yeah,
foot,
absolutely.
All the rest. Yeah. 15,000 respondees. And then what was the result?
So the result was that not a single woman matched Norma on every measurement.
Yeah, right. Well, that kind of goes to the point I was making a minute ago. All right. I mean, do you think in general that we notice normal standards in society only when we spot others who are different from our expectations?
Yeah, I think that's one of the main ways that we do notice them, and that's why I think it's more important to be. That's why I think it's important to be critical of the normal in general, because often it's those differences that we notice, whereas we're not questioning this. The normal itself is very almost hidden. It's so ubiquitous that we don't actually notice or question it, and we don't really think about the fact that what we assume is normal is just as culturally specific as what we think of as being different.
Well, then, is it easier to recognise the existence of a particular definition of normal when you've been excluded from it in one way or another?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. It very often is. And for those people, well, very few lucky people who may never have felt excluded from anything, then perhaps it's quite easy for them to assume that that there's no such thing because they've never really come up against any barriers in their life created from this thing that is normal. But I think for most people, they will have at least one instance where they have found that they don't fit into this definition of normal. And if they haven't, then they just haven't yet.
Yeah, indeed. Like, I'm just looking at one thing here where the World Health Organization is saying one in every eight people live with a mental disorder, anxiety and depression being the big two. And I'm sure you discovered, like, for instance, when you like you do include a number of questionnaires used at various times to analyse respondents, if you like, their mental health and sexual proclivities and all the rest of it and that. When you look through all of them, what's the general kind of conclusion you would come to about them? Is it kind of, yeah, great, absolutely important, but grain of salt at the end of the day?
I think one thing that's interesting for many of these questionnaires is that what they aim to do is perhaps show that things that have been assumed to be unusual actually were less unusual than people thought. So both in terms of the sex questionnaires that found that same-sex partners were more widespread than people had assumed, but also in the late 19th century, the census of hallucinations, where prior to that, many people had assumed that seeing or hearing things that other people didn't was a symptom of a dangerous mental illness. But for this census of hallucinations, they found that actually hallucinations were really much more widespread than people had thought. And for many people, they were not any sign of illness and they were quite able to incorporate them into their lives. So I think sometimes these large studies like that can be helpful in that they can buck against the social assumptions by saying actually something's more common than you think.
Well, look, I mean, OK, well, now then, in the third decade of this century, do you think we have moved on to a certain extent from the Victorian times of like hysteria being the female problem all the time and men's problem was the disease of civilization?
I think on many of these things things have changed, and certainly there are a number of things that we're perhaps more inclined to see on a spectrum, but also in some ways we are less questioning of the normal than perhaps in some earlier periods. And I think in the 1950s and 60s there was quite a lot of questioning of what is normal, why do we think it's a good idea? Maybe actually normal is not a good thing and we should be moving away from it. And I think a lot of that questioning did get lost in the later 20th century and a number of normal standards and ideas simply accepted. So I think there's kind of two sides of it. In some ways we've moved away, in some ways we haven't.
Indeed. Well, there's fascinating stuff in here. There's loads. By the way, you are a researcher at Queen's Mary University of London. Am I Normal? The 200-year search for normal people and why they don't exist. So I'm welcome. That's Sarah Cheney. So Sarah, just a final question is, does circumstance get to decide what's normal? Or if it's people, who gets to decide what's normal in the year that we live in now?
It's a good question. I think throughout much of history, it's been a very specific set of people who have decided what's normal, and I guess we can go back to the idea of weird in science, that a very small proportion of people from white Western industrialized countries are actually used to to create standards by which the whole world can often be judged, and often assumed that everyone should fall along this average. And I think that is still the case to an extent, although certainly as we see in the case of weird, this was a term coined by a number of scientists, and there are certainly people fighting against that now.
I was just going to say congratulations. I never heard weird before, and that's a brilliant one. I'm going to use it. I thought you coined it. Western, educated, industrialised, rich, democratic. Perfect. Sarah, listen, thank you so much for talking with us on the programme today.
You're very welcome. Dave Fanning on 2FM.